Welcome to the Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Tristan Hallman. My co-hosts this week are public safety reporter Naomi Martin.
Hi, Tristan.
And our courts reporter, Sarah Mervosh.
Hey.
We have two guests today. One's calling in, one will be in the studio. Carmen White, who's a high-ranking prosecutor with the Dallas County District Attorney's Office, and Zandra Anderson, an animal law expert, will be talking to them about animal cruelty. And today we'll talk about Oak Lawn and Dallas police response times. Editorial writer Mike Hashimoto will weigh in on that as well. But first, let's talk pot. Melissa Repko, our colleague, is in the studio with us. Melissa, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Melissa, the county and Dallas police are working on a plan to have a cite and release system, which basically means if you have a small amount of marijuana, you get ticketed. What's going on with that?
So it's been a discussion for a while now, but city council members would like Dallas police to look into having a pilot program that would test out how it would work and how it could potentially save time to give people a court summons when they're caught with pot rather than taking them to jail and processing them and filling in a bunch of paperwork.
And I thought Councilman Kingston made an interesting argument at the council. He's talked a little bit about how he sees this as sort of like an fighting an injustice that sort of like the arrests sort of disproportionately affect young black men. Have you heard arguments about like that from other people too? Like, what are the advocates saying?
Yes, I've heard that from some advocates. Josh Gravens, for example, a local activist, has started a petition, an online petition about it. But also Clay Jenkins, the county judge, has spoken about how it could be part of a national movement to keep people out of jail, especially nonviolent offenders.
So how small amount are we talking?
We're talking 4 ounces or less.
Asking for a friend. No, I'm kidding.
So don't have a backpack full of pot, but it's 4 ounces or less, and that's a pretty substantial amount. But if you look at it, it's typically what would be found on someone if they were pulled over for a traffic ticket and maybe it's found on them. Typically, that's how Chief David Brown said they're caught.
Now, there is sort of the downside to this that could be for, you know, a problem for police in that pot generally gives them the right to, you know, search people for other things or bring them in for other crimes. Is that concern being expressed?
Definitely. Chief Brown was talking about how sometimes arresting someone for a smaller offense such as marijuana could lead them to be caught for another crime such as robbery or a more serious offense. So he said he was conflicted because on the one hand, it could save police time that it takes to book someone into jail. But on the other hand, it could keep them from catching some perpetrators.
But the law does allow them to, you know, discretion if they do feel the need to arrest someone, right? I mean, they can still arrest them if they feel like this person might have committed a murder, but all they have is the marijuana, or they feel like this person is a suspect in another crime, like they could still arrest them under this new system, right?
Exactly. It's more of a policy or a guideline, but ultimately it would be the officer's discretion.
So we've heard about this being talked about for a while. So what's taking so long and when will this go into effect?
Well, I've heard from a number of people, including Travis County, who already has done cite and release, that there's always a leeriness among politicians and police about looking soft on crime, particularly drug crime. So I think that's part of the problem. But then also there's a court that needs to be set up. There's paperwork that needs to be written. And all those things, all the red tape can delay initiatives like this.
Melissa, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Over the weekend, we had some seemingly big news, an arrest in connection with a violent robbery in Oak Lawn. Naomi, you got the arrest warrant affidavit for this on Monday. What did it have to say?
So the woman was coming out of she was standing next to her car on the fourth floor of a parking garage, and she said that a man came up to her, pointed a gun at her, and basically she was trying to get her keys and wallet out to give to him, and he hit her over the head with his gun. She fell to the ground. He was telling her he was going to kill her. She eventually handed over her stuff. And then another guy came up who you interviewed, and we'll hear from him in a minute. And that guy allegedly also pointed a gun at her and asked for her purse. And she said the other guy has everything. And so then they got in her car, drove away. And the police arrested these two suspects about an hour and a half, 2 hours later, when they were driving down Cedar Springs. The police noticed the car was stolen, and they found all the victim's stolen property inside the car. Now, the police are trumpeting this as a two possible suspects in a string of robberies and one hate crime that was targeting a gay man in the Oaklawn area and has left the Oaklawn community on edge. But these two suspects haven't actually been arrested in any of those crimes. And so, you know, the police are still trying to figure out whether they are actually linked to those. You know, you talked to the suspect.
Right. I talked to one of them yesterday. He says that he really had nothing to do with it and that he has nothing to do with the rest of the robberies in Oaklawn.
It's just a bunch of bull. And I need justice, sir. And I feel sorry for them homosexuals that got, you know, beat up or whatever and robbed. Because I got a lot of gay people. I mean, well, you know, LB, how you say it? Lesbian and gay in my family. You know, my mama used to go with a transgender. So if I had problems with them, I could have beat my mama's ex up, you know? And I would have never had a relationship like I had. You can call Will. His name Will. I don't know his last name, but you can ask my mama. But we had a great relationship, sir.
So you have nothing against gay people?
No, I don't.
Well, clearly not the most enlightened fellow. He's a high school student, and he says that he doesn't rob people. Police, for what it's worth, have said they have not connected any of these crimes to the other people, and they've done photo lineups with the victims. So it looks like there may be still some attackers out there. Sarah, you live in Oaklawn. Is there still a police presence? Is this fear still palpable there?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, when I first saw the initial headline this weekend, I thought, oh, I was, you know, thinking there had been some major progress that had been made. But, I later learned, no, possibly not quite. And I was actually grocery shopping at the Kroger in the medical district, which is basically right between where the alleged hate crime and some of these other robberies have occurred on Cedar Springs and Oaklawn, and then where this medical district, the most recent one, occurred. And I was talking to the cashier, and she didn't even really know what was going on. But people want to know, but they're like, sort of, no one really knows, like, what's happening.
And I did talk to Councilman Adam Madrano, who represents that district, on Monday after these arrests were made. And he said that he wants everyone to still be on edge and walk in groups and be aware of their surroundings, not just think like, oh, because these arrests were made, we can all let our guard down now. He's really concerned about that. Tristan, what did this guy tell you was his story? Like, what did he say about that night?
Basically that he got tricked every step of the way by this guy, and this guy owed him money. He knew him for a while, but he owed him money, so he thought they were going to go get money from his grandma's house. And each time they showed up somewhere, it seemed like he was up to no good. And he alleged that his friend was smoking K2 marijuana the whole night and was basically acting a little bit nuts. So we didn't hear from both sides, but the other guy did confess to what happened.
So Dallas Police Chief David Brown on Tuesday talked to the City Council's Public Safety Committee about response times and how they have been an issue this year for the first time in his 5-year tenure as chief. They were the slowest they've been in 7 years over the summer. And so he says he's gotten a handle on it since then. They have improved because he's moved more cops to the streets and call volumes are lower in colder weather and there's fewer crimes in colder weather. So he was basically telling the council, you know, the response times have improved somewhat. They're still not where we'd like them to be. They're missing their goals in a lot of the call categories. But overall, they've improved. But he told them that he needs more cops to sustain these improvements and keep fighting crime and doing community relations and all that stuff. So, Tristan, you've covered the department for a long time. Has the chief ever asked for more cops before?
No, and in fact, he's been being hit on that a little bit, at least publicly. He hasn't asked for more cops, and that's sort of been a long time coming. And he even recently at a Safer Dallas board meeting told Charles Terrell, who's sort of the architect of the 3 officers per 1,000 is the standard that we need rule, that he was right, that, you know, that they should have been pushing for more cops. And over the last couple of years, Brown has seen the force diminish. It's down several hundred cops from when he took office in 2010. The city's population, although it shrunk in the 2010 census, you look around, it's growing. I mean, there's more people working here. There's more people living here. There are more people to protect. And while the crime numbers are down, there's still a pretty high 911 call load. So they're having to deal with with the aspect of how many people do you have answering 911 calls? How many people do you have doing crime fighting tasks, so to speak, task force, where they're put out in positions, they're put out in high crime neighborhoods and asked to sort of keep an eye on things or go serve warrants or do community policing. And that's been the struggle right now.
And when I read the story, I was struck by what the numbers actually were for the response time. So even for the most severe, serious, like these are murder, like possible death cases, it's something like, is it about 8 minutes?
Yeah, 8 minutes is the goal. And they're actually, they've been over that goal for pretty much all year. But in recent months, because of redeploying officers to answer more calls, they're just under 8 minutes on average. So that the average, obviously, you'll have cops who are near the scene and they get there in a few seconds. But a lot of those calls are obviously coming in much longer than 8 minutes. And those are crimes that are in progress. You know, your house is getting broken into. You call 911 and say, there's a guy in my house. You know, the cops could be 10 to 15, 20 minutes away.
Yeah, I can imagine being scared. You know, if I was, the victim of a serious crime and I was bleeding or, had a serious injury, that would seem like a long time. And then even the less serious cases, like that was close to 25 minutes.
Right. They have five different priority types, and basically the second priority type, the goal is 12 minutes, and they are way over that on average across the city. The northeast part of the city and other parts of the city are even higher than others. But those are calls like robberies or assaults, and just other serious crimes. And then the third priority calls, the goal is 30 minutes, and they're on average over an hour for those still. And those are things like missing people, intoxicated person, if you're calling to report a recent burglary or a drug house. So those are things that the city council members are saying they're getting the most complaints about, those types of calls, because those are things that people expect a quicker response to, but the police department sees it as its third priority out of five. And so those are the calls that get a backlog, and they keep getting pushed to the bottom of the stack because ones and twos come out.
And that disincentive is people from actually calling the cops about something that could be maybe not the most important thing, but it's still serious in their community.
Right. And you have to sit around because you don't want, if it's a burglary, for instance, you don't want the crime scene contaminated. You want to be able to solve the crime and perhaps get your property back. And that's where I think a lot of the rub is these priority two and three calls are taking way too long by the measure of the goal. And people feel like, if you have your house burglarized, you don't feel like it's a low priority. You feel like this needs to be solved right now.
Or if it's important your kid's missing.
To you.
Or...
Right. Yeah. There's that's where the difference between administrative and sort of the real life application comes in.
And it sounds like Chief Brown has something at stake here, because he's seen crime drop like for the past several years. He's been touting it. I'm helping the crime to drop in our city. But it sounds like it's a little bit borderline possibly going into this last few weeks here.
He does. He has a lot at stake because this is sort of his legacy that, he's helped crime reduce every year for the last 11 years straight. And he's going for his 12th year this year. And it comes up at every council public safety committee meeting that we're looking at 12 years straight this year, and we've reduced crime more than any other city in America. So right now it's about, last month they were about 0.7% fewer crimes than last year. So it's close. And, that's definitely his goal, to be able to say that I've helped reduce crime for 12 straight years.
To be fair, he'd probably say the officers helped reduce it, but he was in either the second in command spot or the top command spot during all of those years, and it certainly does makes a difference to him to be able to claim those things.
Joining us in the studio now is Carmen White, who supervises the animal cruelty unit at the Dallas County DA's office, and Zandra Anderson, who's a Houston lawyer who specializes in animal cruelty law. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
So this week we're going to be talking about a high-profile animal cruelty case that I covered last week, and that was the case of Bradley Bowley. He was accused of putting his two-and-a-half-month-old chihuahua named Buddy on the stove and torturing him until he suffered burns on 100% of his body. A jury found him guilty of animal cruelty, and he was sentenced to 15 months in prison. Carmen, you were in the courtroom with me Friday night. This was a lengthy trial that went into, it was 4 days, but it went late into the night Friday, a 13-hour day on Friday where the jury deliberated for most of the day. What was that like waiting late into the night for a punishment verdict?
I would say it was difficult just waiting late into the night for the guilty verdict. We felt like we had a good case, a case that, you know, deserved a guilty verdict and a just punishment. And so it was a difficult waiting.
About 7 hours of waiting for a guilty verdict.
Yes. And I believe the guilty verdict came late evening.
6 p.m.
6 p.m. And then after some time, we went straight into the punishment verdict. And so it was a long night.
And so what are some of the challenges that the DA's office has faced to getting high, hefty sentences for animal cruelty cases?
Well, I think Zandra would agree with me that animal cruelty cases are difficult when it comes to punishment. I believe people struggle with how they view animals. And I believe some people view them as members of their family. And you have other people who view them as property. And I think the punishment verdicts represent that. I think we struggle for a middle ground, a gray ground. You have people who see it on two extremes. And I think that's what makes it difficult. I also think people struggle with believing that other people would do this to an animal who's clearly helpless.
And Sandra, what are some of the ways that animal cruelty is linked to other crimes?
Well, especially with a juvenile animal cruelty, there has been links to committing greater crimes as that person progresses through life. That certainly has been a link. I can't say that that would be the case in Mr. Bowley's situation. Carmen would know him a lot better, but there's certainly a link to other crimes. Also, when you have a dogfighting ring, for example, and you find dogs that have been left in horrible condition, it's not uncommon to find not only the paraphernalia for dogfighting, but also drugs on the scene as well. Those are common partners in crime, shall we say. And animal cruelty is certainly involved in a dogfighting ring, although you don't have, it's a separate crime under the law. It's been taken out of animal cruelty, and it's a separate crime itself. But nevertheless, there is cruel treatment of those animals, and drugs are prevalent with dogfighting rings.
And Sandra, it's also my understanding that animal cruelty has ties to things like domestic violence and child abuse?
Yes, that's also very true. If a person is going to take advantage and be cruel to an innocent being, that would be true of a dog, a cat, or, you know, someone who is unable to fight back, like an old person, a child, a woman, whoever. They tend to victimize across the board.
Carmen, how do you think the awareness of the animal cruelty issue has changed over the years as far as it being a criminal offense?
I think the issue is growing, meaning people are recognizing now that it is actually a crime. We are instituting a great effort to educate the community as a whole. We have an effort this year that we're going to start of getting out into the neighborhoods, getting to the communities, to the police, law enforcement agencies, and encouraging people, kind of, if you see something, say something. I think
one of the things that Carmen, you and I have talked about in the past is what exactly is animal cruelty, because in the case of Mr. Bowley, where he was, you know, he put the dog on the stove and left him there, you know, that qualified as torture. The jury agreed that that was torture. But in other cases, lesser cases, there's questions of neglect. And, you know, if you see a dog on the street that is, you know, skin and bones and has no access to shelter, that is a form of neglect that can be punishable. Is that correct?
Yes. And so we're encouraging our education effort is to get out there and kind of expand what people believe is animal cruelty and not limit it to the torture cases, but include those cases of pure neglect to the animal. And for people to understand, there is a number to call, that it is criminal, that the police can get involved, that there are agencies that will help in situations like that. And so we're trying to educate the public fully and not limit it to just torture cases.
So it seemed like in this case, you guys had the DA's office had a key witness with the neighbor who had walked in and seen the dog on the stove and taken the dog to the vet and sort of like testified for an entire day about what he saw. Is that unusual for these types of cases, or like how hard is it to like prove that, you know, it just seems sort of rare that you would have someone who like walked in and saw such a blatant, you know, case of animal cruelty?
I would say any case in which the victim is not able to speak is a difficult case. I spent the majority of my career doing child abuse cases, and in a lot of those cases we have infants or children who are not verbal. And the similarities are unbelievable, that oftentimes you have no witness or one witness. It is probably pretty rare that we have a witness who sees a tortured animal or sees something of that nature. And in this case, we had the benefit of having a witness who could tell exactly what they saw. But a lot of times we're proving the case through circumstantial evidence because we don't have eyewitnesses.
Zandra, what got you interested in animal cruelty law?
Well, I think that my passion for animals, and I joke and say my life went to the dogs, because professionally I was a trial attorney and then was kind of burnt out and then got involved in animal law. And if you're involved in animal law and you start getting your name out there, I started getting calls from John Q. Citizen, who was trying to find somebody to talk to who would listen to them about animal cruelty. And so as a result, even though I don't work for the state, in other words, the government, I have helped on several cases, numerous cases, as a matter of fact, help compile information that would help the DA take a case, that would help a police officer get a seizure warrant. And, you know, it has changed. The way that people are viewing animal cruelty has changed over the 11 years I've been involved in it. And it's just like Carmen was saying, now there's some resources for people who are witnessing animal cruelty to call and to tap into, and it's growing because there is a need out there. And so finally the resources are catching up with the need.
And Sandra, and so, it does seem like the public opinion may be changing. I saw on Twitter people reacting to this case with outrage. It was, okay, it's only 15 months. It should be 15 years, although some people did say it should have been 15 days. But that reflects the public divide on this issue. But even though the opinions are changing, the law is still there's certain confines to what these people can be sent to prison for, how long. So what is sort of the range of punishment for these cases, Sandra?
The well, in this case, I thought it was, and Carmen, kudos on this, they tried to use the stove as an instrumentality of a crime to up the punishment and put it into another category. As it stands now with cruelty, your crime, it can be a Class A misdemeanor, which is going to get you up to a $4,000 fine and up to 1 year in jail. And then if you're convicted of a state jail felony, which this, the torture was, then the range of punishment is 180 days to 2 years, and it can go up to a $10,000 fine.
And in now, some cases, so it could be as much as 10 years, which the DA's office was trying to get in this case, but because the jury did not agree that the stove was a deadly weapon, it ended up being a maximum of 2 years, and they went with 15 months in prison. But this just right. This just reflects sort of the challenges that you guys have talked about in prosecuting these cases.
If you have a multiple offender, that will also ramp these cases up. And in this case, I think what the jury probably did is they decided this was animal cruelty, and the punishment was consistent with the punishment in animal cruelty laws in the penal code. If we want greater punishment for animal cruelty, that's a legislative issue. We have to take it up with the legislature, who interestingly meets in the odd years, and they will reconvene in 2017 for a legislative session. And that's when this law could be changed to up the penalties.
Carmen, do you think the penalty, the punishment fits the crime, so to speak, in animal cruelty cases, the way the law is written?
I think when you look, it just depends on what kind of cruelty it is. I think when people torture any being, that we should respect and expect a higher range of punishment. And in this particular case, the state did use the deadly weapon as a stove to increase that range of punishment, which we thought was the appropriate charge for someone who did what he did to this puppy.
Thank you guys both for joining us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for caring about this.
That just about does it for us today. We will have a new Hashing It Out with Mike Hashimoto next. But before we go, we want to thank you for listening. And
wish Tristan a happy birthday. Happy birthday, Tristan.
Thank you very much. It was actually yesterday, but
whatever.
Well, we want to thank you all for taking time out of listening to Serial and listening to our show instead. Remember, you can catch our show every week on iTunes. It comes out Thursday. And remember, you can read all the stories that you heard today and more on DallasNews.com. You can like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We are at Texas Crimecast. Our producer and sound engineer today is Brian Ellich. Thanks to our guests Carmen White and Xandra Anderson and Melissa Repko for coming in. For Naomi Martin and Sarah Mervosh, I'm Tristan Hallman. We hope you stay safe out there. Now we drop the mic.
David Brown is Dallas's police chief. He admits to mixed feelings on paper citations over jail bookings for small amounts of marijuana, and you can see how that might be. The cop in Brown sees minor busts as a tool to develop informants or just information that might lead to bigger busts. An arrest is leverage, even for an ounce or two. The manager in Brown sees it differently. Every minor pot arrest means an officer must drive the suspect downtown for booking. If everything goes well, and well, it never really does, so the officer is stuck waiting. And this is time your average Dallas citizen would prefer to have that cop back on the street making more arrests. Brown is trying to convince the city council that response times would improve with more manpower. It's common sense with a price tag. Freeing more officers from waiting around could help accomplish some of that goal. Instead of booking suspects, a 2007 state law allows written citations for some misdemeanor offenses, including minor marijuana possession. Few departments have taken advantage. But in a city as spread out as Dallas, with policing needs greater than most, cite and summons is at least worth a try. As Brown himself says, it's hard to argue with the practicality.